Our last session, Revelation chapter 13 is where we are for our last session this afternoon. Lord willing, tomorrow morning we will be in Ezekiel and chapter 38 and thinking about the coming Islamic invasion of Israel. I hope you can come back and visit with us and hear that last message. But I want to take you to Revelation chapter 13 and verse 11 as we close out our day together. You've been very patient so far, and we've got over the worst session. The worst session is the third session after lunch, when everybody's had their fish and chips or whatever, and your body is using up energy digesting that good food, and your mind says, I have other things to concentrate on right now besides what that preacher has to say. So hopefully you've done that part. We've kept you awake for the third session, and if you can hang into this fourth session, Lord willing, you'll be blessed, I hope. So let's look in Revelation chapter 13, verse 11. It says, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. And we trust the Lord will bless our reading of his word. The Bible teaches us that following the rapture of the church, there is going to be a period of tribulation upon the earth. Jesus, in the Olivet Discourse, described that period when he said, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. It will be a terrible time, marked by a series of heaven-sent judgments known as the seal judgment, the trumpet judgments, the vial or bowl judgments. And never before has God sent such a sustained and lengthy period of judgment upon the whole earth. You remember, even in the flood, it didn't last for 7 years. So this is a very long and extended period of judgment. And its purpose is not necessarily to make men miserable, but to bring them to their senses, and in particular, to awaken the Jewish people to the reality of Christ as their Messiah, and to allow them to embrace the promises given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So this will be a time of tremendous anti-Semitic onslaught, as we saw this morning. And again, you know, just remind ourselves, Jesus said, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Now, at the heart of this great persecution of the Jewish people lies a global figure. He is described in the early part of Revelation chapter 13 as a beast rising up out of the sea. We understand this beast to be Satan's man, the one we often refer to as the Antichrist. And the scriptures have many names for him. He's called the little horn, the king of fierce countenance, the prince that shall come, the foolish shepherd, the king who shall do according to his will, the man of sin, the son of perdition, the wicked or lawless one, the white horseman of the apocalypse. And of course, here in chapter 13, he's called the beast. He is Satan incarnate, Satan's answer to Christ, and he shall rise to power during the tribulation period that's to come, becoming increasingly more bullish until at last, in the middle of the 7 years, Satan
totally possesses him, and he goes into the temple in Jerusalem where he sits down upon the mercy seat and proclaims himself as divine, even as we read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He's going to demand that everyone should worship him. Now, in our opening reading, we encountered a second significant figure of this period, also referred to as a beast, and this is a different personage. This is the false prophet. He's an altogether different character, and we're told of his mission in verse 12. He causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast. And to do this, he performs specific miracles in verses 13 and 14. And then we read of his mark in verses 16 through 18, the infamous mark of the beast. Now, when I came to Christ in the late 1970s, there was at that time a lot of interest in the prophetic scriptures. In fact, you know, I don't know how it was in this part of the world, but certainly in our part of the world, if you'd have held a prophetic meeting such as this at that time, you would have filled this hall from the very front seat to the very back seat. It would have been standing room only for the most part. So people were tremendously interested in hearing the prophetic scriptures taught, and they were very keen on learning about the end times. But even then, you know, people could see how things were going. But there were matters even back then, for me as a young Christian, that I found very puzzling. I was curious, first of all, about the means of execution during the tribulation period. Scripture speaks of that time, and it says, it speaks of the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus. Now, it seemed to me to be a rather medieval means of execution. But then the thing that we never anticipated was the rise of Islam and its chosen method of dealing with so-called infidels is to behead them. And of course, we have seen that in Syria and other places, even on the streets of our own cities. Sadly, we've had people beheaded simply because the terrorist in question believes that in taking your head off, he is somehow pleasing Allah. And so, you know, we never anticipated that. We never saw that coming. We never saw the great influx of people that would come from the Middle East and Asia who would bring Islam with them in great droves. And so, you know, that was something at that time we thought, well, how could that be? You know, if you're going to execute somebody, you'd shoot them, you'd poison them, you know, maybe you'd electrocute them in an electric chair. Why would you behead them? It seems a very strange and medieval thing to do. But there you are. We're living in an age where people are, sadly, beheaded because of their religion or because of their faith or because of their opposition to the ideology of Islam. Another curiosity to me was this mark of the beast. You know, at the time, book covers on prophetic subjects would present on their cover an image of someone bearing on their head the numbers 666, physically written on their foreheads or tattooed on their heads in some way. And as a young Christian, I thought that was rather crude because I thought to myself, well, you know, who would get a tattoo like that? You know, I mean, you might get the odd person, even in our present society, there are people who are tattooing their faces, but they're not the norm. Most people don't want their faces tattooed. They might get their arms tattooed or their legs, but very few people actually go as far as tattooing their head. And let alone putting a 666 on your head seemed to me to be a rather curious thing to suggest. So later on, you know, as technology moved forward, they had the introduction of the barcode, the famous barcode that you have in all the products that we buy, which is a machine-readable representation of data. And so the graphics changed on the front of these books. Now, instead of having 666 inscribed on their heads, these people had a barcode on their head, much like a packet of crisps or a packet of biscuits or something like that. And that's how Christians in the 1980s and early 90s were anticipating the mark of the beast being worked out. They kind of saw this image of people having been subject by force, I guess, or by compulsion to bear a barcode upon their head or upon their hand. But again, it seemed to me to be a stretch, you know, the idea that, you know, even though I didn't know where this was going, it just seemed like a stretch that people would want to have a barcode on their head. So for this event to happen, certain things have to come to pass. Something had to change. And there had to be a different way of doing things. There had to be some kind of advancement in technology that would allow the mark of the beast to become a practical reality. Now go with me to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 1 speaks about Michael, the archangel, coming to the defense of Israel in the tribulation. Verse 2 talks about the resurrection of the Old Testament saints. And you come to verse 4 and you have this little prophecy that is just nestled in this chapter. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to notice the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. So here's a little prophecy tucked in at the tail end of the book of Daniel. Daniel, of course, being the Old Testament sister book to the book of Revelation. And this book throws a lot of light on the end times. And it speaks of an increase in travel and in knowledge so that man might travel further and faster than before and that he would know more than ever before. Notice it says there that many shall run to and fro and notice, and knowledge shall be increased. Now that's an interesting statement because when you think about both of those things tied together, travel and knowledge, you ask yourself, well, has that been realized? And, you know, if you think firstly of travel in the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton, not only an amazing scientist, but also something of a theologian, said this. This is what he said. A new mode of travel shall be invented in the last days. Knowledge will so increase that man will be able to travel at a rate of, and now he goes out on a limb, man will be able to travel at a rate of 50 miles per hour. Now, in the 1600s, 50 miles an hour was supersonic, I should imagine, okay? And he was very heavily criticized for that remark. The famous atheist philosopher Voltaire said of him, Newton thinks that someday men will travel at 50 miles an hour, and then he added this, the poor dotard, as if he was an imbecile. Well, if Voltaire were alive today, he would have to eat his words. And if Newton was alive today, he would have to revise his figures. You see, now men regularly travel at speeds of up to 100 miles plus on land and 500 miles per hour in the air. You know, coming down from Stoke this morning, you know, we were traveling at 50 miles an hour through the roadworks, and that was now frustrating because it was too slow. And you can't wait for the end of the roadwork sign to come and you can up that to 70 miles an hour and feel like you're making a little bit of ground. But of course, if you went to Germany and to the Autobahns, you know, there are no speed limits and people can conceivably overtake you at 120, 130, 140, 150 miles an hour. So you think about this, you know, land travel, people can travel up to 100 miles an hour. Even in our own country, though there's a 70 mile an hour speed limit, you always get somebody going past you at 100 miles an hour. You often wonder why the police never catch them, but they never seem to do, at least as far as I can see. But in the air right now, even at any given moment, there are 5,000 aircraft in the space above our head, and they're traveling at 500 miles an hour approximately. But even beyond that, if you look at, you know, at the development of flight, today aeronautical engineers are working on a aircraft that will travel at a top speed of 2,664 miles per hour, which is twice as fast as Concorde. It will fly at a height of 62,000 feet, and it will allow you to see from your passenger seat the curvature of the Earth. And you can fly from London to New York in 2 hours. That's the future of air travel if the Lord should tarry. Now, think about that, because 100 years ago, if you wanted to travel any kind of distance, you really had a very limited selection of means to do so. You know, you could walk, and of course, who knows how long that was going to take, or you could sail, you could get on a boat and go somewhere, or if you were, you know, maybe a little better off, you could have a horse or a carriage, and you could ride by horse and carriage. That's how people operated just over 100 years ago. I mentioned to you this morning, you know, Second World War, armies were still using horses. They still had cavalrymen that were going into battle against panzer tanks. So, you know, as late as that, people were still using animals and beasts of burden to get from one place to another. And that is really how men traveled from the time that Noah got off the ark. You know, it's always been that way. You read your Bible, there are people who are going by sea, on boats, there are people who are walking. Jesus walked very regularly, and there are people who travel on animals. So, you know, when you think about travel, believe it or not, about a century ago, to travel for about 100 miles, the time it would have taken you to travel just a short distance like that would have been around 24 hours, okay? 100 miles. Now, from my house to here is about 170 miles. So if you'd have wanted me to preach 100 years ago, I would have had to have left about Thursday to get here, okay? So that's how things have changed. And then if you look beyond our atmosphere into space travel, men are now traveling in space at a speed of 20,000 miles per hour. Now, Newton got it wildly wrong. He was right about the growth in travel, but he was wildly out with his figures. You see, men are traveling to and fro on the earth and even beyond the earth, because even as we're gathering today, there are scientists in NASA right now who are working in engineering, trying to get a man onto the planet Mars. And nothing in Daniel's experience could possibly have prepared him for such a suggestion. He knew nothing like that. So, you know, God says to him, seal up the book, Daniel. There's things here you'll never understand. But understand this, all of this is relating to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Now, we might say, well, knowledge shall increase. Men have always been adding to their knowledge. You know, ever since the invention of the wheel, so to speak, men have always been increasing in their knowledge. And at first glance, that rather seems like stating the obvious. You know, and you know, I remember whenever color television came out, that was a huge advancement in technology. I remember my dad bought a color television so as we could watch the Olympics and the opening ceremony of the Olympics. And he brought myself, my brothers in, and we were all amazed that the Olympics weren't in black and white after all. And so, you know, but where have we gone from then? Much, much further down the road. You see, the Hebrew word translated increased there does not indicate growth by addition. It's not indicating what we call linear growth. So if you could draw a chart of your growth, you know, here you are on the baseline and you're sort of gradually increasing your knowledge like a child does. You know, a child learns how to feed itself, soon it learns how to tie its laces, then it learns how to write and read and so on. So little by little, a child is adding to his or her knowledge. But this word doesn't indicate linear growth. It indicates exponential growth. In other words, you travel along that baseline of the graph so far, and then suddenly there is a very sharp and sudden rise in your knowledge. Now, you understand where we're going with this. According to prophecy, at the end of time, before the Lord comes, knowledge will increase at an incredible rate that has never before been witnessed in human history. In fact, the growth of medical knowledge in the past 50 years has exceeded all the advances in medical knowledge over the previous 2,000 years. Do you appreciate that? You know, you and I are subject to medical treatment and techniques that our forefathers could never have dreamed of, could never have known anything about. You see, we've harnessed things like nuclear power, and we've discovered that it can be, you know, used for a variety of purposes. You know, radiation is used for a variety of purposes. We have phones, we have radio, we have televisions, we have these little computers in our pockets and on our desks and in our briefcases. And all of these things have revolutionized communication. In fact, the so-called smartphone, if you have one of those, you have all four of those items on your possession. Right now, if you have a smartphone, I have an iPhone, so right there I have a telephone. I've got a radio, if I want to listen to a radio. I've got a television, and I have a computer, all in the palm of my hand. Isn't that remarkable? So, you know, when you think about the development of computing and computers, if you go back to the 1970s to get a computer that would do anything akin to a modern smartphone, really, it would have just about filled this room. That's how big it would have been. You couldn't have put it in the boot of your car, let alone put it in your pocket. And now you're just carrying them around. People are walking everywhere, you know, like zombie-like, looking at these screens. So what mankind, it seems, knows more and more. Now, in the mid-20th century, Eric Johnson, president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, said this: knowledge is doubling every 10 years. That was in the middle of the 20th century, 1950s, 1960s, he says. Knowledge is increasing every 10 years. It's doubling. And now, that was before the internet. With the advent of the web, knowledge was doubling approximately every 18 months by 2004. So you think about the things that you have Googled that you would not have known if you did not have an internet. So you're always adding to your knowledge. And according to the computer giant IBM, it won't be long now before your knowledge and my knowledge is doubling every 11 hours. Isn't that powerful? Every 11 hours, you're doubling your knowledge. And if you're of that generation where all of this technology is driving you crazy, spare a thought for those who are studying technology in university and you know, who are sitting through a four-year degree course. And here's what happens to them. By the time they get to the third year of their course, everything they learned in the first year is obsolete. It's redundant. It's useless. So they spend 1 year learning useless information, which was useful at the time, but 3 years later, you know, that's like giving you an abacus. It's you're going back in time. So someone put it this way, and I love this quotation: we are preparing students for jobs that don't exist yet, using technologies that haven't been invented, in order to solve problems that we don't even know we have yet. And that's the world we live in. Now, the world is moving on. Listen to these very simple little facts about modern life. 1/3 of all couples who married in the United States last year first met their marriage partner online. They didn't meet them in real life. They met them on a computer. In fact, in our church this year, I married a young man and a young woman, and they met online. We just been to America, and there's a young man and young woman there that we met there who met online. It's amazing now, if you look at this younger generation, how many of these young people have not met in real life to begin with. They met online, and then they, of course, proceed from that to a real meeting. There are at present over 2 billion Facebook users. That's social media. And if Facebook was a country, it would be the largest country in the world. It would be larger than China or indeed India. If you do Google things, and if you're internet savvy in that way, you will appreciate this statistic: that Google receives 3.5 billion searches every day. That is, there are 40,000 inquiries asked of Google every second of every day. Who did we ask before the internet? Did you ever ask yourself that? You know, if you wanted to know something before the internet, who did you go to? We went to a school teacher. Or maybe you went to your parents. And if you went to your parents, you know what the answer you got most times was, I don't know. And so you went away frustrated. Dad doesn't know. Mom doesn't know. Now if you want to know something, what do? You go, hey, Google. And you ask the question. And a machine answers you back. And it gives you, in most cases, accurate information about the thing that you have asked. Now let's think about texting. I wonder, do you text? I think most people are texting by now. And the first commercial text that ever was sent in December 1992. Now, this very day, get this, more texts have been sent in this day than there are people on the entire planet. That's where we're at. You know, years ago, if you wanted to read or meet you wanted to reach a wide audience by any medium, the chosen medium would have been radio. And it would have taken you about 38 years as a radio broadcaster to build up an audience of about 50 million people. Then television came along, and by the means of television, you could reach an audience of 50 million in 13 years. So that reduced it by two-thirds. Then the internet came along, and they found that you can reach 50 million people in 4 years. Then iPods and MP3 players came along, and that allowed you to do it in 3 years. And now with the advent of social media, actually you can reach a 50 million audience in a matter of a few days. You can reach that kind of number with your message in a few days. Of course, that was something that was evident apparently in the recent American elections. It was also evident during our own referendum, because despite what politicians wanted you to hear, people were communicating their message by means of social media. And consequently, you know, the politicians can't have it all their own way. They can't engineer people to vote a particular way, because people get their information from other sources. And so the audience is much wider, much broader, and they can be reached in a much smaller period of time. So knowledge shall be increased. It's the sign of the times. Now let's think about this matter of the increase of knowledge and technology in the end times. And I want to begin by going to Revelation chapter 1 and verse 7. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 7. A familiar verse where John is introducing us to the subject of the book, the coming of the Lord. And he says this in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 7. Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all the kindreds of the earth shall wail because of him. Even so, amen. Now, can I say to you before we go on that this truth requires no human ingenuity whatsoever? Okay, I want to get that out of the way. You see, when the Lord speaks about his coming again in glory, his glory shall fill the earth. You know, we speak of him coming physically to Jerusalem, but and we understand that he will have a definite presence there, but yet he at the same time is God the Son and the Son of God. And so in that respect, he has an omnipresence. You see that even in the scriptures in John chapter 3, where he says, no man has descended from heaven except the Son of Man, the same which is in heaven. So at one moment he says, you know, here I am on earth, I've descended from heaven to earth, but simultaneously I'm in heaven. You say, well, how can that be? He's God. God is everywhere all at once. He's omnipresent. So when he comes in his glory, he's not going to rely on Sky Television or CNN or the BBC or Channel 4 or anybody else for that matter to make his presence known. In the heavens, the angels cry, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. So when he comes, he's not going to rely on some TV crew being in the right place at the right time to convey his coming. Everybody will know it. But that said, there are other end time events that do require some movement in technology to occur. And that brings us to Revelation chapter 11 and verses 7 through 11. In Revelation chapter 11, we are at the midway point of the tribulation period. And here we read of two witnesses. I believe these two represent the law and the prophets, Moses and Elijah. And they perform various miracles, which indeed coincide with their miracles when they were on earth. The same kind of signs and miracles are given to them. And the world hates them, not just for their miracles, but also for their message. And their message essentially is Christ is coming and you need to get ready. The kingdom is coming. And so in verse 7 it says, and when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. You know what a damning indictment that is upon the city of Jerusalem when we get to the end of time is referred to as Sodom and Egypt, a place that is known for pride and perversion, and a place that embodies the entire system, the entire world system. And he says, and they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3 days and a half, and shall not suffer their dead bodies to be put in the graves. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry, and shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt on the earth. And after 3 days and a half, the spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them. And they heard a great voice from heaven saying, unto them come up hither. And they ascended up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. Now, it doesn't take a genius to work out that thanks to satellite and cable television and news stories being beamed around the world as they happened, it's very easy to see how this might be recorded and how the people of the earth might be witness to this event. It was very striking when the aircraft struck the Twin Towers in New York back in 2001. Remember that actually many people were watching this event on television before the President of the United States was informed about the event. So news teams were already relaying this tragic and treacherous event even as the President himself was being told about it. Now that's our modern world. You see, the days when a news team had to be dispatched to cover a story are fast becoming a thing of the past. There are cameramen and reporters on every street corner. Even in this very hall today, a number of us, if not all of us, have in our possession a camera which will live stream any event that takes place. So, you know, anything that happens in this day and age, what happens? Somebody somewhere gets a phone out, they put their camera on, their video on, and they live stream the event, or they relay that event by means of video. And so the world is now full of cameramen, and so all kinds of world events can be instantly relayed around the globe. You know, many church services are live streamed so that people looking in can watch live as it's going on and see what's happening without the need of the media or any kind of outlet of the media. Now, can you not see that a scenario like that might be played out on the streets of Jerusalem when these two witnesses are killed and then they are raised by the power of God? You see, their message is resented and their lives are taken and their bodies lie on the street only to be miraculously resurrected and ascended into the heavens. That says there of that event that they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see. I think that is going to be a defining moment, don't you, in the tribulation period. I mean, here they are, it's like Christmas the world over. They're giving each other gifts. They're so glad to get rid of these two pesky preachers who've been condemning them and pointing them to the fact that Christ was going to come and they're going to be judged and that there's a terrible end for those who refuse to acknowledge and repent and accept the gospel. And you know, they're lying there, they're dead, they're killed by the beast. The government has put them to death effectively. And the world is rejoicing and partying and laughing and having a good time. And the bodies are lying there and people are out with their cameras, you can imagine that, and all of a sudden they start, you know, dusting themselves down. Can you imagine this? These two dead men get up, brush themselves down, and then they start ascending into the heaven, and here are people watching. And then it'll be, you're never going to believe what I just saw. And that is going to go around the world like wildfire. Now, you may think, well, that may be true of a first world country like Israel or America or Britain or some European nation. But what about third world citizens? How could they possibly be exposed to this kind of news by that particular means? Well, let me say to you that the cost of technology has significantly decreased over the years, so that very many people in the third world, though they may not have enough to eat or drink, many of them possess smartphones. Many of them have the same technology that we enjoy. A couple of years ago in our church, we had a missionary presentation. For the life of me, I can't remember where it was, but it was a third world country. And I remember seeing images of people who were living in corrugated iron houses. They had nothing of this world's goods. They were living in dirt poor, as we would say. They had, rags for clothes. They were struggling to make ends meet. They were finding difficulty, getting their next meal. And the missionary was sharing all of this with our church. And as he was sharing it, I was looking at these little tin shacks, and I noticed that on several of them, there was satellite dishes. And I put my hand up at the end and I said, excuse me, but you tell me these people are really poor and they can't afford very much. But I noticed they've all got satellite dishes. He said, oh yeah, he says, they may not have bread on their table, but they've got satellite TV. He says, and I'll tell you something else. He says, they may wear ragged clothes, but most of them have a smartphone in their pocket. Now that's the world we live in. And, John could never have foreseen that. Yet the technology is there to make the world witness the death and resurrection of God's two witnesses in the midst of the coming tribulation period. Now let's go back to chapter 13 and verse 17. Because here we read that no man may buy or sell during the tribulation without the blessing of the beast and the number of the beast. So it says, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So evidently, the Antichrist is going to have unprecedented control over world commerce. In fact, he will have so much power at this point in history, he will be able to determine who indeed as an individual may be permitted to buy or sell. Now to do that, you have to track people. You have to track people. You have to know where they are and what they're doing and where their money's going or not going, as the case may be. Now our country has become a surveillance society. Do you realize there are almost 50,000 CCTV cameras operated by local authorities throughout Britain, and a similar number is installed in the schools of our land, and 50% of those cameras are inside school buildings. Sophisticated smartphone applications are now capable of building up pictures, not just of our location, but even the context of our location, where we are, what environment we're in. So, we're living in a very strange time. You are photographed. Now, you might be surprised by this, but this is the fact of life in Britain. You and I are photographed up to 300 times a day in this country on various cameras, whether that's on the roads or in your local supermarket, or in a council office, or wherever you go. Almost every building you go into now has a camera and is recording images of you. And they do that very much without your knowledge. My son and I were in Manchester with my wife. My wife and daughters were shopping. And, I said to him, I don't really want to do shopping. Shall we go and do something else while they shop? And we went to a Museum of Modern Life in Manchester. And, I didn't even know what the museum was about. It was just, anything's better than shopping, right? So I went into this museum and was wandering around with my son. And we got to the end of our tour around the museum. And here was our photographs on a board, pinned onto a board. And you were supposed to sign your name under the photograph. And what they said was that in the course of our tour around the museum, they had taken our picture so many times. And they were emphasizing, this is the world you live in. And that's where I learned this statistic. They said that on average, the average British citizen is photographed up to 300 times a day, every day. So you think about that. Here's the reality. Everything you do is being watched. Everything you do is being watched. A security expert by the name of Bruce Schneer, speaking at the BBC's Future World Changing Ideas Summit 4 years ago, said this: every mobile phone you pass, every friend you keep, article you write, site you visit, subject line you type, and packet you route is in the hands of a system whose reach is unlimited, but whose safeguards are not. Indeed, pretty much everything you do can be tracked now. Everything involves a computer. He said, and this you might find this interesting, you know that your Kindle tracks how fast you read, right? So if you have a Kindle and you're reading books on your Kindle, they are tracking the speed at which you can read. You say, why would they do that? Because they want to know when you end your reading so as they can offer you another book. So they know, you know, it takes this person a week to read a book. In a week time, let's offer them another book. You know, it takes them a month to read the book. In a month's time, we'll offer this character another book. Probably they know what kind of books you like to read. So more than likely, you might be offered a romance novel or a thriller or a detective series, something, whatever your particular fancy is. He then says, everything you do online, everything you do on your phone, everything that you do that involves any kind of payment system is tracked. Now, he also pointed out that same comment, they also pointed out that same summit, that many of the mobile phone towers in a vicinity may not even have been set up by mobile phone companies, but governments, both our own government and foreign governments, who want to find out who's walking by and what they're up to. So you're being spied on. You and I are being spied on day and daily by phone towers that nobody knows who owns it. You know, if somebody comes to your street next week and starts erecting a phone tower, who goes out and says, you know, who actually owns this phone tower? You just accept that's modern life. They're erecting a phone tower. Oh, we might get a better signal on our phone. You might. On the other hand, you might find the Chinese or the Russians or the Americans or the British or somebody is listening in and finding out every time you walk past that junction, knowing what you're doing, knowing who you're talking to. You know, public Wi-Fi raises another issue. Do you ever go into a shop now or into a hotel or whatever, and you go in there and you turn your phone on and you get various Wi-Fi addresses, various Wi-Fi offers, and you inevitably get an offer from the shopping mall you're in or from the hotel you're in or wherever it is. Well, you know, since routers now pick up your mobile signal, they're now able, get this, if you're in a supermarket, if you go into Asda or Tesco or whatever, and you use their mobile facilities, they can triangulate not only which supermarket you're in, but they can even tell which aisle you're on at any particular moment. You ever think about that? That's pretty scary, isn't it? Now, here's the interesting thing. My son-in-law, who used to work in IT, told me he used to work for Asda. He was subcontracted to Asda, and his responsibility in this IT company was to provide the technology that Asda uses at their tills, at the automatic tills, you know, those horrible ones that are forever telling you that you've got the wrong thing in your bag or whatever, and as well as the regular tills. And so he was in charge of this, developing this technology. And he told me that they're actually working right now on two things. They're working on facial recognition technology, so that when you walk into a supermarket, they record your face. All your biometric details are taken, and you're now tracked through the supermarket. You go down the aisles, they know who you are, where you are, and what you've purchased. So when you get to the end, your face is recognized. That face is assigned to the items you bought. And then if you come back next week, they catch your face again. They match it with the previous images they have, and they have a fair idea of the kind of things that you might buy. So, for example, if you have a pet, you have a pet cat, and you buy kitty cat on week one, you're going down the pet aisle. They're tracking you. They know where you are. They'll have screens that will come up, and they will offer you special offers, just you, special offers on cat food. You see, there's no point in offering me cat food because I don't have a cat. But if you've got a cat, that's of interest to you. So they'll say, you know, last week you bought kitty cat, this week you need to buy this, whatever other brand name you might care to mention, okay? Now, add to that, they're developing 360-degree scanners on the trolleys. So whereas now you come through with your trolley, you've got to offload everything, and, you've got to go beep, 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 manually, all the items in your trolley have to be paid for. there's coming a point where that's not going to happen. You just take your trolley, and as you push through the checkout, there will be a 360-degree scanner that will instantly identify everything in your trolley, calculate how much it costs, and you won't have to even speak to somebody to pay because they will have your payment details on record and you can just continue on. A green light or something will come up and say, carry on, and you can carry on with your trolley and go and put it in your car and not have to bother with a checkout system. And of course, they're going to use your biometric data for that. They're going to use contactless payment for that. And so it's very easy to see then how you can develop from that point to where somebody somewhere controls who buys and who sells things. Do you really think it's not possible for those who are ruling over us to know who you are, where you are, what you are doing, what you believe, whether you are buying or selling? The technology is there. You see, the information we create as we navigate the world, both physically and digitally, is sometimes referred to as your data footprint, which sounds innocuous enough, a data footprint. You know, I have all kinds of footprints. A data footprint makes no difference. It sounds benign. But actually, your data footprint means that you are leaving behind everywhere you go, and after practically everything you do, much more detailed information than you might care to part with. So, your data footprint will tell those in the know who you are from your most public persona, if you're on social media, right down to your most private moments. They'll know everything about you. So they know who you are, they know where you go, they know who you know, they know who you're connected with, they'll know what you do with your time, they'll know your interests, they'll know your bank details. They'll know your political affiliations. They'll know your religious views. And most of this information, actually, we freely and voluntarily provide for them by means of our online activities. Now, some of it we give away by simply clicking that little box that comes up sometimes where it says, do you agree? And you click the box, I agree. You know, it says, have you read the terms and conditions? And a little box comes up and you go, I agree. Click. Now, seriously, how many of us actually read that stuff? Huh? Who goes through the reams and reams of small print on this website to see what you're agreeing to? You could be agreeing to anything. You could be agreeing to give your children away. You're just going, I agree. Oh, I want this application. I'll agree. You agree? You've just agreed that we can come around and skin you alive and put you on a skewer and roast you? Yeah, I agree. Nobody reads the small print. And so a lot of times what they're doing is they're harvesting your information. They're saying, can we use this information? Your visit to our website, may we draw the material that you share with us out? May we share it with other people? And you go, duh, I agree. You can have all of that. Now, if somebody came and knocked on your door and said, hey, I'd like to know who you are. I'd like to know what you do for a living. I'd like to know what your religious views are, what your political views are, who you vote for. I'd like to know how much money's in your bank. Is that okay? No. You say, get out of here. Who do you think you are? But it comes up on the screen. What do we do? I agree. And we give it all away. Now, do you know one of the first things a police officer does when he's investigating a crime or a traffic accident? One of the very first things he will do is he will seize your mobile phone or your computer. That's what he'll do. If I was to have an accident on the road today, God forbid, but if I should, the first thing that'll happen is the police will seize my phone. Why? Because there's a host of information on that phone. Not least of all, he can tell if I had been on the phone at the moment of the collision. Or even if I had been on the phone 10 minutes before the collision, believe it or not, if you've been talking 10 minutes on the phone before a collision, that's a mitigating factor in whether or not you were paying attention when the accident occurred. So, you know, the same thing if you committed a serious crime, they'll come in, you see it on television all the time. They're walking out with computers in their hands. What are they doing? They're taking away boxes and boxes of information about you. So if you're charged with some crime, They're going to go and look at your online history, and they're going to determine whether or not this is a, there's a pattern there, there's something there that indicates that you were leading up to this moment when you committed the crime, and it was therefore premeditated, either by your disposition or indeed by your preparation for that event. Now, as the development and advancement of human technology continues, not only will the government of Antichrist have information and be able to financially control people, it might well become a necessity. You say, well, how would that be? Look, have you ever heard of molecular manufacturing? You may have heard of 3D printing. Okay, they've now developed 3D printers, in which effectively you can, for want of a better term, but just to make this simple, effectively you can photocopy something in 3D and it can be created on a computer, on a 3D printer, and produced the other side, a complete replica of the thing that you have effectively copied. Now, that's grand. If you want a part for your boiler, and you say, you know, I can go to this 3D printer, and I can put it into the machine, and it will, you know, scan the shape of this part, and in time, another part will come out the other end, and I can go and put that in my boiler or my car or whatever, you know. But what happens with money? You see, I can take a £20 note, put it in a 3D printer, it will scan it, and actually, they're getting to the point where they can accurately reproduce hard currency without any problem circumventing the anti-counterfeiting devices within the note. So if it's possible for counterfeiters to perfectly reproduce currency notes, what's the government to do? How can it possibly deal with the financial markets of the world if people are able at the press of a button to reproduce their own money? And of course, that leads to the point where the government then has to somehow, some way, eradicate physical money and bring you into the world of virtual reality and have you deal with online banking. Now, I've never done this before with a group in my life, but we'll do it tonight. It might go well, it might go badly. How many of us have been encouraged by our banks to go online? If you've been encouraged by your bank, go online. Almost everybody. Almost everybody has been encouraged to go online and bank online. Now, what's happening is that when you do that, the powers that be are able to verify every moment, track every expenditure, they're able to track every purchase, they're able to tell where your financial interests lie. Closing, more and more people are being encouraged into online services, and your financial records are not only being tracked, but ultimately they're going to be governed. Now, where are we going with this? Well, you think about all the things now that are available to you to avoid having to use hard cash. Oyster cards, credit cards, debit cards, Apple Pay, contactless payments, bitcoins, a virtual currency. It's all here. And there's a generation coming up behind us which has less and less need for cash. They just don't want to use cash. Now, here's what the South China Morning Post reported on this. It said, and I want you to listen to this quotation very carefully toward the end. It says, in today's society, it is almost impossible to exist and function without a bank account or credit card. Now, listen to this bit. The entirety of your personal data, not your money, not how much you have, will authoritatively determine what you can and cannot possess in the present or the future. Did you catch that? It's not about how much money you have in your bank account. It's about your personal data. It's about whether you can be approved. It's whether you can indeed be granted the right to possess or not possess something in the future. In other words, a third party is taking account of who you are, what you believe, who you know, what your views are politically, religiously, any other way, and they're going to determine whether or not you can possess something or not possess something. Do you know what that is? It's Revelation chapter 13. No man can buy or sell unless the Antichrist gives his say-so. So we come to this mark in verses 16 and 17 of this chapter, and it says he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. 666. Now, verifying whether someone is authorized or not to buy or sell based on a mark has really been beyond the possibility of technology up to this moment in time. However, given the level of control described by the Bible, enforcement of this system, and the suppression of the inevitable black markets that may emerge has been completely out of the reach of previous generations. So taking this passage in its full context, even at this present time, we don't entirely have the technology that will allow this, but mark my words, it's getting closer day by day. And remember, our knowledge is increasing every 11 hours, and probably less as time goes on. So obviously, a 666 tattoo by itself is not going to be sufficient to enforce that system. A barcode won't do it. In order to succeed, the distinguishing mark must also be paired with a worldwide database containing the necessary personal data and information relevant to the individual and his or her ability to make a financial transaction. Now, as long as the world engages in monetary currencies that can be stored, that can be hidden, that can be traded in secret, government attempts to control the world's commerce will come to nothing. But once you remove the physical currency off the scene, once you get people used to using electronic currency and electronic transactions, you know, and you're no longer now able to store it away under your mattress, what can you do with an Oyster card? You know, we had a man died in our church just two or three months ago, and they went into his home afterwards. He was 90-some years of age. He had £2,000 stuffed underneath of his mattress and his settee, all this money stuffed around his house. Well, listen, if you've got an Oyster card, how are you going to do it? Are you going to hide your Oyster card? Hide your bank card? Because that's no use to anybody but you. And so you see how that by eliminating hard currency and pushing people into electronic transaction, that the government can eliminate at the same time the black market and trade. And so an electronic monetary system of this type, you know, that would have been inconceivable to our forefathers, is within a hair's whisker of achieving. There's an army of entrepreneurs even now who are working on this problem. Now, how will this mark be received? Notice verse 16. And here was the mistake of Christians in the 70s and 80s. It says that you have to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. We thought it was on your right hand or on your forehead. But it's not on, it's in. Now, isn't that interesting? Allow me to introduce you to a character by the name, and you may or may not have heard of him, Jared Kushner. You ever heard of Jared Kushner? Interesting character. He's the outgoing U.S. ambassador to the U.N. The outgoing U.S. ambassador to the U.N. described him as a hidden genius. That was the term she used of him. Nikki Haley said of him that he was a hidden genius. He's the billionaire son-in-law of Donald Trump. He's married to Ivanka Trump. Kushner owns a New York City building that is called 666 Fifth Avenue.
Now, it's not, that's not the number of the building. It's not squeezed between 664 and 668. They've chosen to call the building 666. And, you know, the company that operates inside of it, you know, has a very interesting name. Its name is Lucient. Lucient meaning light. Remember, the devil appears to the angel of light. He's called Lucifer, light bearer. And what does Lucient do? Well, this company conducts research into RFIDs, radio frequency identification chips, and they are designed to be implanted in your right hand between your forefinger and your thumb. In this little bit of skin that is loose here, they can inject or place a microchip that is smaller than a grain of rice that will contain all your personal information. So you think about this. You know, there's a number of things about Kushner that's very interesting. Number one, he's an Orthodox Jew. Number two, he's the president's most senior advisor. And he, you know, he's temporarily stepped down as CEO of these companies that he owns, but he undoubtedly will take that up again. And number three, he is appointed by the president to broker the peace between Israel and the Palestinians. That's all very interesting. Am I telling you that Jared Kushner is the Antichrist? No. I'm not telling you to look for the Antichrist. I'm telling you to look for the Lord Jesus Christ. Christians who look for the Antichrist are looking in the wrong place. We're to be looking up for the coming of the Lord, not looking around for Antichrist. But here's the thing. His chip, this chip that his company is developing, will be able to keep all kinds of data on individuals. So coming back to that scripture, notice the information, the mark is given in, not on the right hand, or in the forehead, which raises the possibility of microchip implantation, but also of facial recognition. Because if your face is indeed attached to your personal data, then they can take your biometric information and decide whether or not you qualify to buy or sell. To give you an example, I went to Manchester Airport a while back. I stood in line. I looked at a camera. The camera had my, the machine had my passport. It was scanning my passport. It was looking at the biometric details that are contained in the microchip on my passport. The camera was assessing whether my facial characteristics matched the biometric details in the passport. And having decided it does, the doors opened and I came in. Now, if they had decided otherwise, the doors were going to stay put and I would have been investigated as a security risk of some kind. I then proceeded through the airport to the point now where I'm ready to go to my gate. I now go up to my gate. I don't have to take out my passport. I just have to look at another camera. And my picture comes up on the screen. And the gate opens and I can go on and catch my flight. Now, if you think about this, how easy is it going to be? Whenever you can take a microchip or your facial recognition technology, and now you have... you have not, you know, you've refused the mark of the beast. You don't have the microchip. Your facial features are not attached to the government agencies that are trying to monitor and govern you. And now you're coming down to the trolley. You've got your trolley full of stuff. You're heading toward the checkout and the scanner goes whizzing around and you're supposed to now wave your hand in some way or they're going to read your face and take your money and let you travel on. But suddenly your face doesn't fit. Your hand doesn't have the information. What happens? Breaks. Sorry. You're not buying anything today. Out. That's where we're coming to. That's where we're coming to. You see, even now women and others are taking these microchip implantations in their person as a means of birth control. You know, vulnerable patients are receiving them that are prone to wander. In America, they've tracked the homeless using these things. Microchips are being used to prevent epileptic seizures. You know, they have glucose sensing microchips in diabetics. They have medical records that are given to health workers that are in those microchips. You know, just in the recent World Olympics, it was suggested suggested that all of the athletes should receive a microchip that would indeed contain their details and be able to ascertain who were drug cheats. There are many good reasons to use this kind of technology, but you mark it down. As many good reasons as there may be to have that kind of technology in your possession, this is the way the world is going, so that Satan might have governance over every individual in the globe. No generation before ours could have realistically foreseen the arrival of those technologies. None before us could have possibly entertained the fulfillment of Revelation chapter 13 outside of the possibility of a coarse inscription of the number 666 upon your head. This advance in knowledge, this exponential advance in knowledge, is one of the strongest arguments that this is potentially the last or very close to the last generation before Jesus comes. It seems certain, friends, that with every passing day, we take a step closer and closer. And someday, we're going to hear the shout. Someday, we're going to hear the voice of the archangel. Someday is going to sound the trump of God. And we who are saved are going to be snatched away to meet the Lord in the air. Satan has his number. 666 is the number of a man. But thank God the Lord Jesus has his number. And his number is 7. The outlook for the world, my friends, is bleak, but the outlook for the church is bright. The Lord is coming. Maranatha, are you ready? May God bless these thoughts to your hearts today.